Good morning, everyone. So when was the last time that you got something new? Or you did something you hadn't done before? Or you went somewhere that you've never been? Something that you were really looking forward to? Something that you were really excited about? I love new things. I get excited about advances in technology. I get excited about new books. I get excited about exploring places that I've never been before. Newness is exciting. And that's the sort of tone that we find in our psalm this morning. The psalmist is excited. He's calling Israel and the whole earth and all of creation itself to get excited with him. Because something new has happened, something so amazing that it demands to be sung about, demands to be rejoiced in. And he tells us two things that he's learnt about God that provokes this reaction in him. Firstly, that God is great. And secondly, that God is judge. We aren't actually told anything specifically in the passage about what the precise surroundings of this psalm are, what events are going on. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 16, David quotes it almost in its entirety. And he does it when the Ark of the Covenant is reclaimed from the Philistines and it's brought into Jerusalem for the first time. Now, whether David was the author of this psalm or not, it doesn't really matter. The fact remains that David applied these words to this event, to the event of the symbol of God's presence coming into Jerusalem, God's city, for the first time. And you remember the joy that David had that day when that happened. We read about him dancing before the Lord as the ark is paraded in to the city. That's the state of David's heart. And this psalm for him captures that mood, that emotion, that joy that he had. And the psalmist, whoever he is, and whatever the situation was, he responds in much the same way as David does. So let's think about those two things that we learn. Firstly, that God is great. This is the reason he gives for his call to sing. Look at verse 4. For great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. God is so great that he deserves to be praised greatly. Deserves to be praised in a widespread fashion. He deserves to be praised by the whole earth. The events that have taken place for the psalmist and the ark coming in to Jerusalem for David have revealed God in such a way that he simply must be praised. But interestingly here, it's not just the nation of Israel that's called to praise. It's the whole earth. So great is God's greatness that it demands praise from everyone, all the earth, all the people, all the nations. And one of God's chief aims in his mission is to make himself known. And if you've read a lot of the Old Testament, you will know that phrases like, that you may know that I am the Lord your God, are very frequent. God reveals himself. The psalmist sees who God reveals himself to be, and his response is to call everyone, everything, to praise him. Notice, though, that this won't happen on its own. Look at the charge that he gives specifically to Israel here. Verse 2. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. Israel are called to tell. Now, this word tell is an interesting one, because in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Old Testament that many of the early Christians would have used. It's called the Septuagint. The word used here for tell is the same word that we get our word evangelize from. That's the sort of feeling that there is here, to go and tell of his salvation. And this actually fits with God's desire, God's purpose for Israel in the first place. This is Isaiah 49, verse 6. God says, I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. So the psalmist, seeing who God is, calls Israel to join God in his mission of making himself known to all nations, so that they can respond in the only adequate way, to respond in praise. But there's more to it than that. Such a revelation of who God is stirs up something else. Look at the second half of verse 4. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the people are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. If you want to flick on, Sam, a couple of slides. Sorry. Yeah, keep going. Yeah, there we go. I love C.S. Lewis' description of Aslan in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. When Susan asks Mr. Beaver if Aslan is safe, do you know the bit I'm talking about? He says, in response to this question, safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. I think this is a really helpful way for us to kind of understand what fearing God means. We don't fear God because he's a tyrant who's going to use us and abuse us, who's going to send a bolt of lightning down at us whenever he's fed up with us. He's not like the other gods. They're worthless. They're meaningless in comparison to the Lord Yahweh. The fear that the whole earth is encouraged to have of Yahweh is not of what he could do to us at any minute, but of the wonder, the majesty of what he has already done and who he is. He's made the heavens. He lives in splendor. He lives in majesty. He is strong. He is beautiful. Fear's not meant to be negative here. It's meant to be positive. It's just simply an acknowledgement and an understanding of who God is, of what God has done. Think for a moment later on in the Bible, in the very last book, in fact, in Revelation, when John sees Jesus on the throne, what's his response? Well, he falls flat on his face. He's terrified. Not because he thinks Jesus is going to smite him, but simply because what he sees is so majestic, so wonderful, so big, that it's all he can do. Fear is, right, a positive response to God, who reveals just how great he is. So that's the first part. God is great. Secondly, God is judge. We see this second call of praise, call to praise, in verse 7. And we have our reason for this second call in verse 13. For he comes to judge the earth. Before we think about what it is about judgment that demands praise, let's have a look at this call to praise. And it's almost like a mirror. Verses 7 to 8, we have this threefold ascribe, where we had the threefold sing in verses 1 and 2. To ascribe means to give what is due, to attribute to God what he deserves. And it's much the same thing as we've seen with regard to his greatness. Acknowledge his glory and his strength. Then look at verse 8. Bring an offering, come into his courts, worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Here there's a call to come to him, to bring an acceptable offering, to worship him because he is judged. But again, there is this sense that God is to be feared, is to be trembled before, because this time, the splendor of holiness. Now, there's a bit of debate as to what this really means. Some think it refers to our own holiness before God, but I would suggest that the flow of the passage seems to suggest that it is God's own holiness, which is splendid, and worshipping him, understanding that, causes trembling, causes that fear that we've already spoken about. Then there's this call again, this encouragement to go and tell it among the nations. They need to know God has established the world. God will judge with equity. But not only that, the psalmist then extends it out explicitly for the first time in the psalm, mentioning creation itself. And he's thorough. Look at, again at verse 11. Let the heavens be glad. Let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord. It's everything that there is. He doesn't leave anything out. All of the peoples, all of the animals, all of the plants, everything that there is, the psalmist calls it to praise God, to rejoice before God, to be glad at what God has done. But all of this then begs the question, well, what is it about God being judged that might cause such jubilation? It's not something we tend to associate with praise. We almost acknowledge it as a lesser evil, something scary that God does. Why does the psalmist say, rejoice? God is coming. God is going to judge. Well, there's a few things that I think we can say. Firstly, the manner of his judgment. Look at the end of the psalm. The psalmist writes, he will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. His judgment will not be like the judgment of the other gods of the nations. He does not judge to inflate his ego or to get some amusement. He does what is right. He treats humanity faithfully. He's fair. And so sets himself apart from the gods of the nations. Now this alone ought to be enough for us to worship and delight in a God who judges like this. But there's more to this story, isn't there? There's more to this song. There's another verse in this new song. The final verse. And we're fortunate to know it. And we know it because, well, we live after the most crucial point in God's mission, Jesus' death and resurrection. And so we know a lot more about this coming that the psalmist speaks of here. He's referring to Jesus' second coming. Now listen to the words of Romans 8. Now these are words that are surrounding the events of Jesus' second coming. This is from verse 19. Paul writes, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. You see, our sin has not just destroyed the relationship we have with God, but it's wreaked havoc with creation itself. It's under the bondage of our sin. So the call to rejoice in the Lord's coming in our psalm, whether the psalmist had knowledge of this or not, is apt because when Christ comes again, He's going to renew all things. He will give to creation the very thing that it's been longing for, that it's been groaning for. So what do we say to all of this then? The new song that the psalmist urges the world to sing is about the mission of God. It's a song about making the great God known, who has saved his people over and over again, and who will return to restore all things, to make all things new. This is the God who has revealed himself to our psalmist, but this is the God who has revealed himself to us in an even greater way. It's in him that we see the greatest. It's in Jesus that we see the greatest, most marvelous work of God, the cross of Christ, which has saved us once and for all from our sin, meaning that we no longer dread his return, but eagerly await it, along with all of creation, because it's then that he will make us new, and we will reign with him for eternity. God's mission is incredible, and as we know, he calls us to be a part of it, and we see that in our psalm, don't we? He encourages Israel to tell, to declare, to say among the nations of his salvation, of his marvelous works, that he reigns over all. He encourages Israel to tell the nations to come, to worship, to offer what they have to God. Now, as part of God's people, actually, our call isn't all that different, is it? We just know a bit more of the song. We've got a bit more to sing about. But how do we do it? Well, there's lots of ways that we can do it, isn't there? But one way that I want to highlight, and you can flick on, Sam, is the 14th of December, 4 p.m., Brunton Park. Lots of the churches in our city are getting together, are joining together to put on the Hope Carol service. We've been given 100 tickets. I think that there are now 78 tickets left. Can I encourage you this morning? Can I challenge you this morning? Don't let this opportunity pass you by. Our city loves Christmas. And every week we have a planning and a prayer meeting for this event. And the stories that I hear from everyone, really, is that people who normally wouldn't be seen dead in a church or at a Christian event, not only are prepared to come to this, but actually really want to come to this. Now, why is that? Well, I think, yes, of course, it's because it's a spectacle, because it hasn't been done before in our city. But also, and I really believe this, I really believe that God is behind this. I really believe that he's going to use this event. Why not join him by buying some tickets for yourself and maybe buy some tickets for some of your friends and then pray that God would direct you to the people he wants you to invite. And maybe you're here this morning and you're feeling a bit skeptical by this. You're saying, well, actually, none of my friends are going to come along to this. Let me encourage you. Why not take a few extra and then pray that God will prove you wrong, that he will surprise you? I think this could be a potentially extremely significant moment for hundreds of people in our city. The sign-up sheets at the back. Now, wouldn't it be brilliant if I had to go to Miriam and ask her for some more tickets for our church? I encourage you to back this, to take the plunge, to ask some people to come along. What an opportunity this is to respond to our psalmist's call, to recognize and help Carlisle see the greatness of our God. But we also desperately need to hold this up to God in prayer. And we've seen fit that we should have a 24-hour prayer event for this, and that's going to be on the 28th of November. It's a Friday. It's at 7 p.m. it starts. And this time what's happened is that all the churches have been allocated some hours to pray. We've been allocated 10 to 11 on Friday night and 1 till 2 on Saturday afternoon. And then the hours between like 12 and 6 in the morning have been kind of left for those people who are prepared to sacrifice some sleep to pray. New churches have been a lot of those. But it's a great opportunity to join with the other Christians in our city and to pray, not just for this event, but to pray for our city together. Will you come along to that? Will you join me there? There's a sign-up sheet at the back. Please do consider coming along and signing up for that. And there's one more thing that I want to challenge us about. It's something that I personally have been challenged about a lot over the last few weeks. And that's that the gospel calls us to tell, yes, with our mouths, but also to tell with our lives, to love radically, to love our neighbor radically, like Rob was talking about last Sunday evening. There's a story that I want to read that I read a few weeks ago, and which I think illustrates this point quite beautifully. It's a story from Seoul in South Korea. And there, hundreds of babies are born with deafness or blindness or cerebral palsy or Down syndrome. And they're actually abandoned on the streets, as well, actually, as many born to single women because of the shame culture which they live in. Pastor Lee Yong Yak has developed a quite brilliant way of showing grace. This is him in the picture here. He's made a baby deposit box where babies can be left anonymously. So whenever you open it, you put the baby in and you close it, an alarm goes off. And Pastor Lee goes down and finds the baby there. Now, this one man in the last 5 years has saved 561 babies who otherwise would have been left on the street to die. In fact, he himself has adopted 19 of them. Isn't that an incredible story? This certainly is radical love, isn't it? It's radical, creative grace, which mirrors the way in which the early church functions. They looked after the sick and nursed unwanted children, didn't they? Pastor Lee didn't just lament at the evils of his culture. Instead, he sought to do something about it. He saw a need and he did what he could to meet it. And that's what a life that lives the gospel looks like. It sees need and it meets it, not because it deserves to be met necessarily, but often because, in fact, it doesn't deserve to be met. Now, yes, there is such a profound wealth of need in our city that it would be easy for us just to be paralyzed, to do nothing, to join the naysayers and complain about all of it. But a life that lives the gospel sees need and then starts. It gets creative, it thinks seriously, it prays hard, and then it goes for it. And this is not just something which is corporate, although it is corporate. This is something which is individual, which all of us need to take on board. What needs do we see in our city? Now, which ones then of those needs that we see could we meet personally? It doesn't necessarily need to be as radical as Pastor Lee. Often it can be quite simple, but how can we extend grace personally to the people who we live around, or to the people who we work with, or to the people who we see in the street? So let's just take 1 minute and think about those three things. So the carol service, the prayer meeting and what you can do personally to meet some of the need. You say, I encourage you to take that away and to pray about it. Well, 1 minute, and then I'll pray and I'll hand it back over to Sue.